Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter.
Hello, and welcome back to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. Hello, everyone. This will be another of those episodes in which Alex and I do a deep dive into an issue within the area of climate-related security. And today's topic is farmer-herder conflicts.
If you work with climate, environment, development, humanitarian assistance, or adjacent areas in the Sahel or sub-Saharan Africa, you have certainly come across this particular type of conflict, which to a great extent shape the security dynamics of the region.
And farmer-herder conflicts, they encompass so much in terms of cross-cutting issues that we felt it's an important topic to address in depth and maybe help also sidestep a few misconceptions. But first off, what are farmer-herder conflicts? Tell us, Alex.
Okay, so farmer-herder conflicts are mostly local, sporadic, and low-intensity conflicts over issues around resource sharing, like land use, that can be crop cultivation, grazing for livestock, and the kind of disputes that also include access to water and livestock raiding. There's a long history of fluctuating conflict, competition, and cooperation between farmers and herders that include periods of violent herder domination over settled farming production systems, as well as the conversion of land use for pastoral uses into cultivation. And I think it's also important to mention that these kinds of conflicts usually happen without direct involvement of the governments, and they also rarely interact with more violent conflicts. This can happen, and for example, we see this in Darfur after the outbreak of the civil war, and then there, farmer-herder conflicts were interacting with more violent conflicts, but this isn't very common. And coming back to resource sharing and competition, farmers and herders, of course, use the same land. So these kinds of conflicts arise when herds encroach on cultivated areas and damage crops, or when water resources are becoming heavily strained. Before we continue, I also want to mention herder-herder conflicts. We also see conflicts between different pastoralist groups in some areas. For example, in South Sudan, two rival pastoralist groups, the Dinka and the Nuer, have historically competed over grazing land and water for cattle. Until 2013, these clashes generally took place within the local context, and they didn't cause large amounts of fatalities. But after the dismissal of the former vice president, Nuer, by the South Sudanese president, Dinka, this act served as a catalyst for mass violence.
And how are these specific conflicts related or relevant for climate security, environmental security?
So climate change has resulted in an increasingly higher temperatures and more frequent and intense extreme weather events like droughts, which can lead to increased water scarcity and changes in access and availability of natural resources. Looking back at the previous example of South Sudan, traditionally, cattle raids are a livelihood-sustaining practice, and this allows the restocking of herds after droughts. It's also noteworthy to mention that this has an important cultural function. It provides a means for young men to be married, which in the past has historically also marked periods of cooperation between these two groups in their long history. And of course, access to water and pastures is central for local communities in South Sudan. During the dry season, different sections of the Dinka and Nuer have to migrate in search for water places, often infringing on land claimed by other communities. And this ends up giving both a pretext and an opportunity for resource conflicts and cattle raiding. This dynamic has been amplified by progressive warming and more frequent droughts in South Sudan. And before we move on, I also want to mention some of the other long-term trends and events that are also causing farmer-herder conflicts. And these include the availability of modern weapons since around the mid-1980s, economic crisis and macroeconomic factors, privatization of land, in some places, influx of new groups of people, new technologies that have led to change in land use and an influx of new settlers. And looking at the contemporary context, there does seem to be an increase in conflict in the post-independence period. And a lot of this evidence comes from farmer and herder testimonies. So maybe then you can give us a little bit more context on the background for why we've seen some of this pattern.
Yeah, I think that for us to understand why this particular type of conflict has emerged and is also becoming more frequent and also more violent, it is worth taking a look at how things used to be before the onset of a conflict culture, if one can call it like that, between these two groups. So the economic activities of farming crops and herding cattle for livelihood purposes have been around for many thousands of years, I think between 10 and 12,000 years. And the communities conducting these activities, they have lived side by side in the same regions and had also, we know that today, they had a symbiotic relationship with one another, even perhaps depending on one another to thrive. And by that, I mean that you have farmers managing land and soil, and through this management, making it more fertile, more moist, more overall viable for food production. And then you have, at the same time, cattle needing a constant supply of water and grass, but also leaving behind fertilizers, cleaning up the land, making it also more viable for farming, and also preventing forest fires. And just a bit of a side note here, because I think this doesn't come up enough, we know that cattle produces manure, right? So solid fertilizer, which can be really valuable for soil quality. But we don't speak a lot about the value and the use of cattle urine, which can also be used as a fertilizer, and in some contexts, even sprayed as pest control. So this is just a bit of a sidelight comment, but I thought it's important to talk about because we tend to focus a lot on how water intensive cattle can be, which is true. It is water intensive, but we kind of leave out of this equation the fact that the water being consumed is also being returned to nature, particularly when you're talking about traditional free-range cattle, right? This is not relevant at all for industrial cattle production because in those contexts, this concentration is pretty much toxic and a pollutant rather than good for nature. But just bringing in the fact that there is a symbiotic relationship between farmers and herders and how they have been supporting each other's livelihoods historically.
Very interesting indeed. I have to say, I didn't expect on this Friday morning we'd be discussing cattle urine. But it's true. I had never really thought about this symbiotic relationship beyond this kind of one sentence of this exists, this is the relationship, but not how it actually works. But coming back to this main topic and the symbiotic relationship between herders and farmers, what went wrong?
Yeah, amazing question. We are here at the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. We are all about climate, of course. So it gets very tempting for us to just say climate change is making resources scarcer. So these groups are not competing for the little amount of resources that is available. And it does make sense. It wouldn't be necessarily untrue because we do live under the pressure of a changing climate. Resources are in fact becoming scarcer. We know that. Population growth is something I don't like to mention this all the time because I don't feel like we always should talk about how the population is growing. It's not like wherever the population is bigger, that's where more resources are used. It's actually not true because resources are mostly used in places where wealth is bigger, not where population is bigger. But we can't also oversee the fact that if you are already in a situation of scarcity and you have very fast population growth, and in the African continent, it is really the case that it is faster and larger than everywhere else in the world currently, the growth of the population. But I think we would be making a mistake to not acknowledge the elephant in the room, so the role that colonialism had in the region and how it has been also a driving force behind so many of the existing conflict dynamics in the region. And farmer-herder conflicts will certainly fall under this category. And the mechanism through which colonialism in Africa is linked to today's farmer-herder conflict is, to put it on a short sentence, but we'll explain better later, through the alteration in access and distribution of resources. and subsequently the breaking down of the social contract, which had been in place between these groups for so long. And I'll get a bit more into that now. Firstly, let's get into how colonialism has altered access to resources. So basically, concepts such as land property, national borders, were de facto inexistent in pre-colonial times, at least in the way that we understand those concepts today. So when cattle herders crossed through lands looking for water and grasslands to feed their cattle, they were not committing any crime because they weren't breaking and entering anyone's properties or illegally crossing a border of another country. None of this pretty much existed. I'm saying pretty much because pretty sure there were local arrangements that we're not aware of, but certainly not in the form that we understand those things today. So the introduction of these dynamics through colonialism has led to an imbalance between communities, because whereas they used to enjoy a certain equality, let's say, at least coexist, from that point onwards, one of the groups, namely the herders, had their activity practically outlawed, not de jure, but de facto, because they were then only able to herd on public lands, now, which are often completely barren. Farmers, on the other hand, were in a slightly better situation, not a good one, certainly being under colonial power, but definitely better than the herders, because European colonialists were coming from agricultural societies. So they would have recognized the activity as a legitimate livelihood strategy. And again, the concept of owning land very much plays into the farming logic.
Before moving on, I really wanted to highlight your point on population growth and how often, when it comes to food security, when it comes to farmer herder conflict, this point is so highly emphasized. But in reality, I like your point that we have higher resource use in nations, in areas where wealth is higher versus population.
Yeah, now it's always easy to look back and say that everything was so amazing back then. But of course, we can assume that things don't always go smoothly. This symbiotic relationship would have had its hiccups, like everything else in life. And we know that this is the case because there are several traditional mediation mechanisms that were in place in different communities throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And of course, if mediation existed, it's because it was needed. So these people were dealing with their disputes and mechanisms were in place. But once the dynamics shifted to a more hierarchical one, for lack of a better word, with one group being less favored, more excluded from benefits than others, this is when these mechanisms fall apart. And that's what was meant with the breaking down of social contracts. This is a point that was made by United Nations Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohamed a few years ago. I very clearly remember her talking about this. I don't remember the specific context, but I do remember how she broke down the situation for those of us who don't come from the region and don't often know how things turn out the way they did. But I've been speaking also about how the dynamics brought about by colonialism have, with time and up until today, created an unfavorable environment for nomadic herding. But of course, farmers also suffered immensely under colonial power and are still dealing with the consequences today, just like all local populations did and do. The reality is that their lands were also taken from them. Many traditional peoples who have been living and managing lands and ecosystems have been expelled of their ancestral homes, left to fend off for themselves. So just imagine now both farmers and herders are being denied access to and use of many forests, fertile lands, bodies of water. And now they're having to compete for very little resources that remain available for them, with herders having now been pretty much downgraded to invaders. This comes on top of everything. And something I haven't mentioned yet, but which is a very important consequence for the dynamics of conflict, which is that whether you're a farmer or a herder, has pretty much to do with your ethnicity. So these activities have always been conducted by specific ethnic groups, and this persists until today. Of course, dynamics have changed, but for example, today, the Fulani herders in Nigeria and the Oma herders in Kenya are Muslims, while most of the farming communities in the region, if not all of them, are predominantly Christian. We already see there a further element that may push for conflict. Now, throw in the population growth we spoke about before being so much more advanced in sub-Saharan Africa and climate change, We haven't even spoken about that too much. Climate change, environmental degradation, the advancement of things like degradation and desertification, all pretty explosive.
I think one of the points that I also want to highlight that we've been talking not around a little bit, but haven't said it maybe quite so clearly, is that climate and environmental change is an aggravating factor. Of course, climate change is increasing. We're seeing droughts getting worse, being more intense, being longer. So it's certainly something that we need to be focused on because it's only going to become more and more of an issue. But we do often hear about it and often also speak about it as if it was an underlying factor. So like I said, I don't want to minimize the role of climate change, especially because it is growing. But often in all of these cases, conflict dynamics already existed. And even if climate change were to be fixed tomorrow, there would still not be an immediate sustainable peace. But it's really incredibly important that they're addressed together. For example, it's really important to act on intermediary factors to mitigate conflicts.
Exactly. Like you said, we can't just count on climate change actually stopping, right? Or even the horrific impacts of colonialism that has had in Africa to be reversed overnight. That would be great. And I feel like we should keep trying to do those things even when they seem utopic. But we also have to act today, concretely, to mitigate risks and reduce also the chances of disputes turning into conflict. And when it comes to farmer-herder conflicts, there are a few specific entry points that can be taken. One is to address the lack of livelihood alternatives. So this kind of like absolute dependence on a single livelihood strategy, it means that when it fails, violence becomes a valid option if there's no other alternative. If you need to make ends meet, you have a family to sustain, you might just say, okay, my livelihood failed. There is no alternative. I'm going to defend it or look for another one with violence so that it becomes a valid option. And we can't let that happen. This is something that needs to be tackled. And it requires consulting with the affected populations, of course, getting local, even national governments involved in planning and strategy. Ideally, the plan would be, of course, to ensure that both farmers and herders have an alternative path or a trade to follow. For example, when drought hits, things such as tapping into strategically placed reservoirs or organizing transhumans flows. We didn't speak about transhumans yet. Transhumans is slightly different than nomadic herding. Nomadic herding is more patternless, so to say. So nomadic herders, their move has less of a pattern, whereas transhumans would be a more organized flow following the seasons and also pretty much determined who moves where and when. This is much more organized when we talk about transhumans, but they're similar. And of course, this is not always possible. So governments must also have a backup plan, maybe be ready to provide aid in crisis situations and avert conflict. Very important and very concrete entry point is also to tackle recruitment to armed groups. And we know well now that there has been a lot of evidence pointing to the fact that non-state conflict actors like rebel groups, jihadists, armed groups, they actively recruit young males in these contexts of failing livelihood. So they come in, they tap into the grievances of people. And of course, if you're fighting for your survival, you are marginalized within your own society and you often have to resort to violence to survive. You have grievances, understandably. So they come in, they tap into these grievances with promises of justice. They also tap into people's religious beliefs, offer a much more stable income than they have. And there you go. You have a lot of young males armed, enraged, and ready to perpetrate violence. So would their lack of livelihood be addressed? And would they be informed and educated about this danger? Perhaps you could reduce the rates of this happening. Another entry point, we hear this a lot, but it's a little bit more difficult one, pertains to early warning systems. Early warning systems require a lot of resources. They're technical, they're expensive, they need a lot of investment. So this is something that the international community can help because by providing these developing contexts with early warning systems, then the local populations and the governments together themselves can make use of this information themselves. So you don't need to, the interpretation and the action upon the information they receive through these systems can be done. So it's a form of empowerment. It's support and empowerment for the countries and the regions.
I also want to bring in one of the recommendations from our weathering risk publication, Climate Peace and Security Assessment Mali. So one of the recommendations in this report is to encourage agroecological, climate smart, and conflict sensitive practices by starting and expanding interventions and communications in order to improve security and livelihoods in sustainable and conflict-sensitive ways. And one of the ways that this can be done is through supporting farmers to improve self-sufficiency and soil productivity, including via community seed banks and investing in production of biofertilizers, herbicides, pesticides. And also a really important factor is through supporting dialogue channels for farmers to reach out and to communities affected by the use of chemical products to explore joint ideas for recompense and share information on alternative agroecological and climate smart processes. And it's really important to highlight that sharing information across identity groups on mutually beneficial farming techniques can also help create trust and build social cohesion between groups, as well as enhance climate resilience and food security. And that's one of the things, bringing in some of your points, talking about colonialism and the breakdown of social ties, there's also a way to build that back up. And it's really important through environmental peace building, through this dialogue and exchange, to build social ties and to make sure that peace building is done in a climate sensitive way and really brings people together and increases social cohesion. Some other peace building efforts that we can also highlight: greater investments and increased capacities in order to also minimize inherent competition over natural resources, which is one of the precursors mentioned to farmer-herder conflicts. One measure that can be taken is greater investments and increased capacities should be built on alternative feed and fodder resources. This will help minimize that. And one of the things we've also addressed throughout this episode is, of course, water resources, and those becoming more and more scarce due to climate change and due to population growth to a certain extent. And increase in availability of basic resources, which could be done through things like more water spots. And those can be built for farmers for irrigation, but also will benefit herders for animal drinking.
Thank you, Alex. Yeah, we spoke today about how farmer-herder conflicts emerge from the competition between farming and herding communities for scarce water and also scarce land resources. We also spoke about the African continent's colonial history and how it's a driving force behind many of the region's conflict dynamics and farmer-herder conflicts included, by affecting availability and use of resources by the local population, and also by promoting animosity between ethnic and religious groups, which holds up until today. We also looked into how climate change is now heightening tensions by putting further pressures on resources. We spoke about a few ideas of entry points that can be used to address intermediary factors to try and stop this competition for resources to turn into conflict. Finally, we also looked into some opportunities for acting on risks and trying and reducing the risk of disputes turning into conflicts by addressing intermediary entry points, such as addressing recruitment to armed groups, early warning systems, and agroecological climate smart practices tackling the lack of alternative livelihoods. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this one.
Thanks, everyone. And thanks, Raquel. It's always so nice when we can sit down and have a conversation between the two of us and really do this kind of deep dive into a topic like this.
True story. Those are the most fun ones.
Yeah, they really are.
And for those of you who are maybe conducting research or you would like just to know more about farmer-herder conflicts, take a look at the Climate Diplomacy platform, climate-diplomacy.org. In the tab case studies, you find a map, and there are several farmer-herder conflicts that have been listed there that you can take a look into. The case studies are looked to in depth. So they have conceptual models, they have actor constellations, reconciliation attempts, and there's quite a lot there. If you're conducting research on this or would like to know more about, do take a look. We'll also put some link below. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks.
This was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. We will be back with another episode in a few weeks. Follow our latest updates on Twitter under Climate Diplo and also on LinkedIn. Thank you for tuning in. And until next time, goodbye. Thank you.